Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Medical Monday, December 28th. I'm Ray Graff. Support comes from Saratoga Hospital, introducing the Center for Wound Care and Hyperbaric Medicine at its Wilton Mall location at its new Hyperbaric Chamber program, saratogahospital.org. Due to the COVID-19 pandemic, many people are feeling more isolated and depressed than ever. On top of that, the days are darker, the weather's colder. Joining us today is psychiatrist Dr. Mark Rapp of Albany Medical Center. He's ready to answer your psychiatry questions. If you have one, I advise you to call early. 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number is 800-348-2551. Psychiatry, right after the news. Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Joining us for Medical Monday today is Dr. Mark Rapp of Albany Medical Center. He's ready to answer your psychiatry questions. Dr. Mark Rapp obtained his medical degree from Robert Wood Johnson Medical School and completed his residency in psychiatry at the University of Virginia. He is also board certified in consultation liaison psychiatry, his major area of clinical activity throughout his career. Dr. Rapp is currently associate professor and vice chair for clinical services at Albany Med. He joined Albany Med after 13 years at Penn State Health. If you have a question pertaining to psychiatry, give us a call. 800-348-2551 is the number, 1-800-348-2551, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Again, the number is 800-348-2551. Dr. Mark Rapp, welcome to the program, sir.
Hi, thank you.
Very nice to have you here. You know, it occurs to me that the 9-10 months that we have been as a society essentially in lockdown and in more isolation than we have seen before, it's something that we haven't really dealt with as a society. And I imagine in many ways you are at the front lines of things. Now, over the course of this, one of the maddening things about doing Medical Monday is that there is so much anecdotal information. This vaccine looks effective. This treatment looks effective. Oh, this is a cause. This is not a cause. Psychiatry, it seems to me, is an area where this has hit the country in an amazingly powerful way. And there have been a few studies, right? So in June, the CDC surveyed 5,000 people. They found that due to this pandemic, there was increased substance use, increased suicidal ideations. That was in June. Then in September, the Journal of the American Medical Association published a study that found that depression has tripled among those with less than $5,000 in their savings account. Given that most of the studies that we see of any substance take a couple of years to really get their focus, do you think that we're just seeing the tip of the iceberg here?
You know, Ray, I'm glad you brought that up, because what scares me is what I don't see. So I work in Albany Medical Center. I see patients who are already admitted for medical reasons. I see patients who present for a primary psychiatric complaint. The folks I'm not seeing are the folks who are at home, hanging on by the skin of their teeth. And our ability to even access that population and understand what kind of troubles they're facing is actually quite difficult during a pandemic. I think what we don't know is in some ways much more scary.
How do you, as a consultation liaison psychiatrist, deal with things that we have not dealt with before? Now, you have dealt with people who have felt isolated and alone in society before, but have you seen it on such a mass scale, and are you equipped? Is your profession equipped to deal with this?
I think it's fair to say that, as with many things during the pandemic, we've never seen it on such a mass scale, no. And it's across the board. It's children, it's adults, it's seniors. Everybody is affected by this. And in some ways, it's worse because everybody's affected unevenly. So my work day isn't terribly different. I get up and drive to the hospital, much as I have done. But there are people who have been out of work since the beginning of the pandemic. There are people whose lives are radically changed in their work practices. The effect has been vast, and it's been across every strata of the population. What I see are people who are ill enough to make it into the hospital. What I see are people who are either presenting with a primary psychiatric complaint or people who have other medical illness, including COVID. And so I know I'm only seeing a very small proportion of that population. So to be quite frank, I don't think my profession alone is equipped to handle the entirety of the population, of which I'm sure a substantial portion are pretty seriously affected. Fortunately, there are other resources, and for some people, they might be enough. There are certainly other people in mental health who reach out to a broader swath of the population. But I think if we imagine this working and in an individual doctor-patient relationship, no, we're certainly inadequate.
Dr. Mark Rapp of Albany Medical Center joins us today. Psychiatry Today on this Medical Monday. Our number is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Well, then we have this whole seasonal business and seasonal affective disorder, which I gather is just because we live here in the Great White North where there is not much light and not much heat about half the year. How has that compounded what you are seeing?
I think seasonal affective disorder as an entity, you know, about 20 to 25% of everybody has significant seasonality to their moods. They don't necessarily have a disorder, but they certainly feel distinctly less happy and less energetic during the winter months. A smaller proportion of people are affected with a disorder that's severe enough to impact their function. I think the short answer is it's not helping anything. And we're also probably not at the worst of that peak. As you know, seasonal affective disorder is going to depend on latitude. And as you go further north, it's more likely to be severe. I have to say, having traveled from Hershey, Pennsylvania, much closer to the Mason-Dixon line, I forgot just how short the days become up here. And Our clock, the one that sits in our head and sort of sets the rhythm for the rest of our bodies, is set to about 24 hours. Mm-hmm. We can only move that clock around so much. So if you've ever had jet lag, you know a little bit about seasonal affective disorder. It's like being jet lagged for a prolonged period of time. I think one of the things that people can do about that is bright light therapy. And for roughly two-thirds of people with mild seasonal affective disorder, and about half of people even with severe seasonal affective disorder, it can actually give them complete remission. But it's really hard to do. And typically, you need a device that is fairly expensive and to really follow instructions.
I'm sorry, why do you have to have an expensive light?
Well, most lights are quite dim, actually, and because of the way our brain has been set up, we require a really bright light to reset that clock in our head. So daylight is sometimes 60,000 lux. If you're sitting in your office, you might only be at 800 or 1100 lux. And that's if you're in a really brightly lit area. Typically, bright light therapy is done with 10,000 lux. Hmm. So it's typically a specialty device. It's a very bright light. And you also have to remember you can't be very far from it. This is typically one of the problems that people encounter. They buy the light, they put it across the room, and they say, why isn't it working? And the answer is, well, it's not 10,000 lux when you're 14 feet away.
That's fascinating. I wonder why some people are more affected by this disorder than others. I've lived in the Northeast my entire life. You know, I'm grumpy most of the time, but I don't feel any worse in the winter. I don't understand why are some people more affected by this?
Boy, I wish I could answer that one. And one would think that populations of people who were more affected would move and populations who were less affected would stay. But it doesn't really look like that. So seasonal affective disorder is fairly common even in places like Norway.
You know, we'll take a quick break here. And may I say, Dr. Mark Rapp, you're the first person to ever sort of infer that Hershey, Pennsylvania was tropical. So I think that's a good thing to be optimistic about. Our number is 800-348-2551. We'll get to the phones. We'll get to the email bag in a moment. It's Vox Pop. It's Medical Monday. Ray Graff with you at 800-348-2551. We're joined today by Dr. Mark Rapp of Albany Medical Center, and psychiatry is our topic today. A couple of emails here, doctor, and then we'll go to the phones. This one is from Holly in Orange County. Can you explain the difference between borderline personality and bipolar disorder? My friend's daughter, 18 years old, has a psychiatrist and a psychologist slash therapist disputing the diagnosis.
While I wouldn't say an area of particular expertise of mine, borderline personality disorder is a personality disorder, which is to say it's a persistent way of experiencing the world. And although it's characterized by lability, that is mood that moves around a lot, it's typically reactive and it's not prolonged mood states. Whereas bipolar disorder is a mood disorder that's characterized by alternating between much more common prolonged depressive episodes with much more rare episodes of mania, that is, discrete periods of sustained, abnormally elevated, expansive or irritable mood associated with increased energy, decreased need for sleep, and relative disinhibition. So people with borderline personality disorder are, in effect, always labile, but reactive. That is, their mood changes based on what's going on in the world. And they also tend to have trouble with impulsivity all the time. Borderline personality disorder is distinct in that it's a change from one's baseline.
Okay. This one is from JP in Ulster County, and then we'll hit the phones. The number is 800-348-2551. If you have a question for Dr. Mark Rapp today, JP in Ulster County writes, do you have an opinion on current studies of the efficacy and safety of SAMe 200 milligram and Lactobacillus plantarum on depression? If so, is there evidence more SAMe 400 milligrams, for instance, would work better? I don't even know what I just read, but maybe you can help us out.
I can try. So SAMe is a compound that's actually fairly difficult to create and transport. One of the problems with studies using SAMe is that if it's not synthesized relatively recently, the chemical falls apart. So it's actually a little bit hard to study. And there is some evidence that it can be helpful, but It's a little difficult to study because of the fragility of the molecule, and it's difficult to look at to compare studies because of that. I suspect that one of the problems is a lot of what's sold as SAMe isn't. But I think it's a lot like melatonin. When you actually study what's in the bottle, it's not necessarily the same potency or even compound you expect. And this is, of course, an artifact of some of these compounds not being regulated by the FDA.
Now, do you have evidence of this, or is this just your gut that the SAMe that's out there is not necessarily the right stuff?
Well, it's a little bit more than my gut. I think if you look at the synthetic chemistry and the way the compound can be safely maintained, that is, without falling apart, it's a little hard to imagine how you put it in a bottle, put it on a store shelf, and have the same compound in the bottle weeks or months later. Mm-hmm. It could happen, but I think it's hard to know, and it would also make it much harder to compare. When they do studies with a compound that they're fairly sure is actually there, it does look somewhat promising, but it's probably a little impractical as a result.
We're joined today by Dr. Mark Rapp of Albany Medical Center. Psychiatry today on this Medical Monday. The number is 800-348-2551. John is in Beacon. John, you're on.
Yes, hi. Thank you. Great show. My question basically is regarding masks. And I wanted to get the doctor's take on whether about what he thought on people that don't wear them versus people that do. It seems to me, I mean, my just, you know, off the cuff areas, it's kind of the thing that happens in war when, the you know, it's thought that the guy next to you is going to get killed, but you won't. Is some sort of denial going on or fear of death or, you know, what is that dynamic that you see in people?
You know, John, I'm glad you asked that. And I have to confess right now, I'm not wearing a mask. which is actually really odd because I've gotten used to the way I sound with a mask. As I practice psychiatry with a mask on and recognize that people are not reading my facial expressions in the same way they might normally, there have been some interesting changes just because of it. I think it's become very polarizing, and I think that there are people who are showing other allegiances, perhaps expressing their political view by not wearing a mask. At the same time, I think you're dead on that for a lot of people, COVID is a theoretical, right? We don't see the illness. We don't see the virus. And for most of us, we don't see the people who are sick with it. So it becomes easy to push it further away. And I think one of the reasons why people get less careful over the course of a pandemic, even as we're being told that we need to be more careful, is that we don't directly observe the effect. And our brains are not evolved we're not set up to imagine this potentially lethal virus just lurking out there. We don't see it. We don't feel it. We don't hear it. It's hard to keep focused on something that we can't see, feel, or hear.
It becomes an abstraction.
I think it's an abstraction. And I think with the addition that denial is certainly alive and well, and being able to say, I don't need a mask because I'll be fine, is certainly comforting in that moment.
John, thank you very much for the call. Dr. Mark Rapp of Albany Medical Center is our guest today. You know, you mentioned something interesting that I have to bring up here. You made a point that, you know, you're usually wearing masks and your patients are not able to read your expressions. So is it your goal for a sort of a biofeedback loop where your patients can read your expressions, or do you have to maintain a poker face during your sessions?
You know, Ray, I have always taught my residents and have in turn been taught by my mentors, when all else fails, act human. And patients aren't just looking to me to be stone-faced. They're looking for the usual cues that I'm listening to them. They're looking for the usual cues that I react to their distress. I don't think that it's any easier with masks, but I certainly don't wear one even when I'm not wearing one. And I think that people in psychiatry have to titrate and regulate their expression, but I don't think they have to not have one.
Dr. Mark Rapp is our guest today. Back to the phones, 800-348-2551. Jim in Matamoros, Pennsylvania. Jim.
If a person is constantly trashing or putting other people down, are they most likely suffering from an inferiority complex?
I'm so sorry. I missed the beginning of your question, sir.
If a person is constantly trashing or putting other people down, are they most likely suffering from an inferiority complex?
I don't know that I can say in every case that that's true, but I think that particularly during a pandemic, there are a lot of angry people. And I think that I and my colleagues have observed even otherwise genial physicians being a little shorter, a little angrier. Certainly there is more cynicism than there used to be. I think that there is some expression of distress that we're sharing when we put other people down. I think it can also be because we feel unsure, we feel anxious. It's not at all unusual for people to express their hostility, whether it's turned inward or outward, by being cynical. It can be erosive, and I think that it's not necessarily inferiority, but I think it's almost always linked to some other source of anger. And I think it's been something that you've probably observed a great deal of during the pandemic.
Why do you think more cynicism is in play now during a pandemic lockdown?
I think that people's efforts to protect themselves from the despair they might otherwise feel during an event like this, we use humor. And sometimes we use humor that's bitter. And at the worst, we use cynicism. We say, it's as I expected it. See, it's just as bad as I thought. And it doesn't protect us necessarily from the feeling, but it gives us something else to hang on to.
Dr. Mark Rapp is our guest. It's Medical Monday Psychiatry Today. The number is 800-348-2551. Thomas is in Saugerties. Thomas, you're on.
Hi there. My question is about the shortage of mental health care in the country as a whole, and if you could sort of talk about maybe what the industry is trying to do about that.
Oh, thank you so much for that question. This is a topic about which I have, I'm afraid, a great deal of opinion. Let me start with some facts. And one is that most of the psychiatric workforce is older. In fact, a considerable portion is close to retiring or even past retirement age. At the same time, fewer psychiatric physicians are taking insurance, so that the population of psychiatrists who are open to a wide array of insurances has shrunk. And I think what we see is a system that has created incentives for lots and lots of other specialties and disincentivized psychiatry. And I think efforts to address that have been aimed at encouraging people to consider a career in psychiatry. They've been aimed at encouraging other specialties to be aware of mental health issues. I think these have probably so far proven inadequate. And I think some of the incentives are pretty simple. If you pay a great deal of money for people who do, granted, very difficult, time-consuming work, you will have more providers who practice in that specialty. If you make it harder, if you denigrate it, if you throw up complexity that adds to frustration but doesn't add to care, fewer people will practice it. And I think that, unfortunately, I have not seen a great turn in how the American healthcare system encourages mental health care to approach the kinds of increases in numbers that it needs. There are very few places in the United States that have an adequate mental health workforce, and they're typically clustered around academic medical centers on the East and West Coast.
Thomas, thank you very much for an interesting call. The number is 800-348-2551. Let's go to Hunter and John. You're on. Go ahead.
Yes. Good afternoon, Dr. Rapp. I'll give you a very brief history and then get to the point of my question. Around 20 years ago, I was in my general practitioner's office, and he prescribed for me an antidepressant that proved to be sort of counterproductive. I much later learned, 10 years after that fact, that I am what's known as bipolar 2. As a result of that prescription. And this was, I had a practice in New York City for about 12 years, and this occurred around 2001. as a result of that intervention, I lost my license to practice. Since then, I've you know, done a lot of work and self-evaluation. I feel safely. Safe to say, I can return to my profession. Of course, that would involve a reinstatement. Have you had any experience with professionals who have, you know, lost the license, perhaps, and tried to get back into their profession? And what resources might you steer me to in order to achieve what I'd like to do?
Hunter, I'm sorry you had that experience. And as you know, in medicine, our state of knowledge evolves over time. And I hope that the physician who is treating you quickly recognize that the antidepressant was counterproductive. I have had some experience with physicians who have been out of practice for a period of time. Unfortunately, not in the state of New York. I've only been here for about 6 months. In Pennsylvania, there are a number of organizations that have helped physicians reenter the workforce. And I think every state has some form of impaired professional program, but they're of varying utility. And I'm not familiar enough with New York's to really be able to comment intelligently. On the other hand, I do hope that you find some way to use your talents. And I'm deeply sorry that things worked out so badly 20 years ago.
John, thanks a lot for the call. The number is 800-348-2551. Dr. Mark Rapp joins us today from Albany Medical Center. And we'll grab one more before the next break. Peter in Poughkeepsie. Peter, you're on.
Hello. I have a acquaintance who was diagnosed as schizophrenic over 40 years ago. And that condition still remains. That individual's in a group home type setting now. And I call once a year on their birthday. That's my minimal contact. They still have delusions. They still give off information about religion and authorities who are speaking to them. So my question is, because my contact is so minimal, just once a year, over the phone, I'm very removed from contact. And, of course, this is a very generalized example, but do I just ignore what they say? Do I humor them, yes them to death? Or do I try and be discouraging or present another opinion?
Peter, that's a great question, and it's one I'm frequently asked. How do I approach somebody who has delusions? And I think it's a little difficult to grasp because we're used to a give and take in conversation where we at least attempt to convince the other party of our point of view. By definition, a delusion is fixed and false. And as you may have experienced, there's really no amount of data that is going to talk your friend out of his perspective. So certainly directly confronting delusions is not helpful and probably never has been, at least in that kind of conversational setting. I think at the same time, you don't have to accept their worldview either. So I think it's probably counterproductive to just go along with it. I think the road lies in the middle, and I think it's fair to say that in everyday life, we meet people who have disparate views and disparate perspective. Somehow we manage to speak with them. And I think it's probably best to be able to find the common ground with your friend and to be able to maintain that connection, which is probably a really good thing for your friend.
Let's take a quick break. Dr. Mark Rapp of Albany Medical Center is our guest. The number is 800-348-2551. It's Psychiatry Today on Medical Monday. We'll be right back. It's Vox Pop Medical Monday. Ray Graff with you at 800-348-2551. Dr. Mark Rapp of Albany Medical Center joins us. And before we get back to the phones, let's just follow up on our last caller who talked about a friend of his who was diagnosed with schizophrenia. In your studies and in your professional career, what have we learned about the physical causes of schizophrenia?
Ray, in 1950, a French surgeon spoke with his brother-in-law, who was a psychiatrist, about a medication that he was using for nausea. And this eventually led to the first antipsychotic medication, chlorpromazine. Since that time, virtually every medication we have used for schizophrenia has in some way done the same thing as chlorpromazine. Some in more clever and refined ways, some in identical ways. But essentially, we have been hammering away at the same mechanism since 1950. This has not led to remarkable breakthroughs. This has not led to remission of schizophrenia. There are just now, in the last several years, efforts to look at other pathways in the brain, other chemicals to address schizophrenia. This is in its infancy. There are no agents out there that are radically different, that are approved for use. This may change soon, but currently we are still working on 1950s technology, and that technology is one way or another to reduce dopamine in the brain. Alas, we know that this isn't the whole problem. We know that in some ways, when we reduce dopamine where we don't want to, we can actually make some symptoms a bit worse. We know that these drugs can relieve some of the frightening hallucinations and delusions, but they're a very, very incomplete and very variable and sometimes ineffective set of therapies. I am hoping that we are much closer to finding new and interesting ways to address this disorder. We have innumerable genetic studies. Just a few years ago, we had some breakthrough studies concerning some of the common genetic elements that we see in schizophrenia. But one of the problems is that every time we do a genetic study for schizophrenia, we have a finding that doesn't quite take us to a new therapy. So we've gotten somewhere, but it's been very, very slow.
And so you know then in the past 50 to 70 years that dopamine levels play a role. I assume then that there is not a physical test where you could say, hey, doctor, I think I'm schizophrenic, and you can do a medical test and say, oh, yeah, you got it.
In some ways, I wish it were that simple, but I think as with many things in medicine, we're looking at a syndrome. That is, there are many, many different facets, everything from physiology to function. So, for example, we know that people with schizophrenia have some differences on average in eye movements. We know that individuals with schizophrenia have some differences on average in their EEG, their electroencephalogram. But none of these are specific enough to be diagnostic. And unfortunately, we're still relying on a clinical definition for a disorder that probably varies more greatly than any other diagnosis in not just psychiatry, but perhaps in most other fields of medicine.
Does the range of the diagnosis sort of give you pause?
Oh, yes. There are people who are barely affected, but clearly have the entire syndrome. There are people who are profoundly affected, who never function, and we call it the same thing. We have reason to believe that there are variations within that vast category, but we struggle to hang on to their significance over time. The DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, has been in continuous publication for quite some time, and the fourth edition continued to list various subtypes of schizophrenia. The fifth edition just dropped them. It just decided that we weren't good enough at separating them. That is, there wasn't enough inter-rater reliability to continue to describe these subtypes of schizophrenia. It just wasn't robust of a concept enough to continue that label.
Let's jump back to the phones here in our remaining 10 or 11 minutes. Dr. Mark Rapp is our guest. Dr. Rapp of Albany Medical Center. The number is 800-348-2551. We go to Carrie. No, I'm sorry. We go to Maria in Kerhonkson. Maria.
Hi. So how are you? I have a daughter who's 24 years old.
Well, we're having trouble hearing you, Maria. Give it one more shot. I think we lost Maria. What do you do with a connection like... Oh, here we go. Go ahead.
Yeah, so they told her she was on the spectrum of bipolar. But she knows that if she were to be diagnosed with that, that she would need probably medication. So she refuses to get help.
A tough one to hear, doctor. Did you get enough of that?
I did. And Maria, I am so sorry that your daughter's struggling. I think one of the difficulties with almost every disorder I deal with as a psychiatrist is some loss or deficit in insight, some inability to see the same difficulty that other people see. And unfortunately, that's a tough one to overcome. And I think lots of strategies have been tried with varying success. My recommendation would be to use all of them. And that is sometimes asking someone, look, are you better off in treatment or out? What do other people say to you? I understand why this is hard for you to believe, but here's what other people see or say to me. It's very difficult to convince somebody of something they don't want to believe. And I think it's very typical in almost all mental illnesses that people have a specific loss of insight that makes it harder. This is actually not too foreign to our everyday experience. If I get a certain haircut and I think it looks good, maybe I'll be easily dissuaded if others say, what a terrible haircut. But if I have that specific loss of insight, then I will just assume that other people are jealous, or I will come up with other explanations in my head, and it doesn't change my view of the haircut. And I think what we see in most mental illnesses is something much more profound, of course. If you're paranoid, someone telling you you're paranoid has got to be because they are out to get you. There's no other explanation that makes sense. If someone tells you that you seem angry and you don't feel angry, gosh, that makes your blood boil. It's very difficult to have that kind of insight.
Maria, thank you very much for the call. Sorry the connection wasn't very good. The number is 800-348-2551. Carrie in Blandford. Carrie, you're on.
Thank you. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I was diagnosed as bipolar a little over 15 years ago, and fortunate for me, my protocol was successful right from the get-go. I have had to tweak it over the years, but not too bad. I've never been hospitalized in that. Fast forward, my daughter was diagnosed bipolar 6 years ago, and for the kid, it's been a total nightmare. No one has been able to find a protocol that works for her. She's had to be hospitalized. The medication I take wasn't successful for her, and we just recently heard about genetic testing, which we were wondering if that might help show what kind of medication she should take, and also we can't find a provider, so I'm wondering what you think we should do with that, and I'll hang up.
Okay, thanks a lot for the call.
Well, that's a couple of tough ones, and I'm sorry that your daughter's struggling. As you know, mood disorders tend to be heritable, although not perfectly. And we always would think, well, if a medication works for the parent, maybe it will work for the child. Unfortunately, These disorders are also complicated. We're not talking about a single gene. We're not even talking about dozens of genes. And so treatment is going to vary a great deal. Brains tend to be more different from each other than any other organ in humans. And sometimes there's a period of trial and error, hopefully informed by good knowledge of psychopharmacology. I think that there are some evidence-based guidelines for how to proceed in treating a disorder like bipolar disorder that are at least organized. They're a systematic way to establish an effective therapy. They're not always going to be successful, but I think it makes a lot more sense to be systematic in one's approach and to be able to at least eliminate unsuccessful therapies, hopefully on your way to finding a successful therapy. As far as providers, as I mentioned earlier, we have a desperate shortage of mental health providers in the United States, and New York is no different. I think one of the things you can do is call your insurance provider. That will be frustrating, I promise. They will give you a list of names, some of whom are no longer in practice, some of whom aren't taking patients. But I think that another good approach is to get that list and attack it systematically, recognizing that you are in a part of the world where there is that shortage and where it is going to be a struggle. I wish I could do more.
Let's go back to the phones. We'll grab at least one more, and we'll also hit the email bag before we wrap up the program here. Dr. Rapp, Karen in Albany. Karen, you're on.
Hi, Dr. Rapp. Thank you for taking my call. I have a question regarding long-time use of anti-anxiety medication, specifically Klonopin and Xanax. I'm talking like years worth, like a decade, actually. And could that affect your cortisol level in the sense that I basically live in fight or flight constantly because of my PTSD, and my cortisol levels have always been normal.
Interesting. So let me start at the beginning and work my way back a little bit. So certainly sedative hypnotic drugs of the benzodiazepine class, like Klonopin and Xanax, should lower your cortisol level when they're effective. And that's fairly typical. And their prolonged use, we anticipate them becoming less and less effective over time. That is, as you develop tolerance to the drug's effect and continue to take the same amount, it's going to have a smaller and smaller effect size over time.
Right.
So if the drug is, let's say, somewhat effective, one would anticipate that your cortisol level would go up on average as it became less effective. There's just one problem with measuring cortisol level, and that is it varies tremendously over the course of the day. So a random cortisol level is nearly unhelpful. Certainly,
right, it has to be 7 o'clock, right?
Well, and your actual peak will vary depending on your bedtime and where your circadian clock sits. So even 7 a.m. is just a rough estimate. But because it varies so much, it's possible that you sort of catch it at the wrong moment and it looks fine. The only thing that would be really telling is if it was terribly high.
Okay, great. Thank you so much.
Sure. Cortisol is also an indirect measure of your sort of autonomic arousal and your state of anxiety. So it's not a perfect correlation.
All right. This one is from AC in Ulster County. What number lux do you recommend for an appropriate light box? Remember, we were talking about the happy lights earlier.
Sure. It's 10,000 at eye level. There are a couple of devices that use specific wavelengths, for example, green, that might be lower. But I would suggest finding a reputable company that makes medical-grade seasonal affective disorder lights. And following the instructions, the most shocking of which is you have to be just a foot or so away from the light.
Hmm. Does a tanning light work? You go in with the eye goggles on, and away you go.
No, I'm afraid not, because they're really designed to do terrible things to your skin by emitting ultraviolet radiation.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of radiation is not part of the visible spectrum that you need to reset the clock in your head. So you actually need to see it.
Okay.
And it needs to be pretty darn bright.
All right, this one's from Donna, and we're only seconds away from closing up the program. But Donna wrote in and said, what are the doctor's thoughts on the use of THC while taking antidepressants, specifically fluoxetine? Does the use of the former interfere with the functioning of the latter? And that's from Donna.
I have a very succinct answer to this. I don't know. Alas, we have not studied this well enough to answer that question. I don't have enough information to even bend one way or another. And one of the problems with our history with cannabis is because it hasn't been studied very systematically, we have an infinite array of questions and very, very few answers.
Well, I'm afraid that's where we will have to leave it. Dr. Mark Rapp, thank you very much for being with us today. I hope you come back. Apparently not, since he's gone for good. Wow, well done. Oh, no, he's still there. Oh, thank you, Dr.
Yes,
Rapp.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Appreciate it very much, you being here. Support comes from Pinnacle Behavioral Health, Albany, New York, offering TMS, transcranial magnetic stimulation, a non-invasive treatment for moderate to severe depression. PinnacleBehavioralHealth.com for information. All right, that's it for today. Once again, thanks to Dr. Mark Rapp of Albany Medical Center for being here. Thank you for joining us. Terrific questions. I apologize to all those left on the line. Hey, we'll do this one again real soon, and we'll try to get you in there. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer, our producer, Jackie Orchard. Our phones answered by Joe Makowitz. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow on the big program, 2 p.m., mark this on your calendar. It's the Copyright Forum. Right now, stand by for the Media Project.